Welcome to the podcast version of Sunday Miscellany, which differs from the radio version for rights reasons. We hope you enjoy the programme.
We'd just been shown to our table, and the waiter was about to get some menus, when my travelling companion piped up with the first and only words of Italian I would hear her speak. Vino rosso pronto, per favore. It was clear that no menu would ever be looked at before a calming glass of house wine had been served. My companion and new best friend was the renowned journalist, civil rights campaigner and feminist, Nell McCafferty. We had been sent to Italy to cover Ireland's pivotal World Cup game against Romania for the Pat Kenny radio show. I knew Nell by reputation only, so when we met at Dublin Airport, I was a little taken aback to see that her luggage comprised two T-shirts, assorted underwear, and a toothbrush, which she carried in a squashed-up plastic shopping bag. "What more do I need?" she said. "Sure, we'll only be away for 2 days." Now, while a trip to Italy might appear to be a dishy assignment, the catch was that we'd been asked to travel at less than 24 hours' notice. We had no hotel bookings, no match tickets, no Italian lira, but I'd managed to find us rooms in a modest hotel about 30 kilometres south of Genoa. By the time we sat down in that friendly trattoria, we were both completely whacked out and famished. We'd been living on our wits since leaving Dublin that morning, but now at least we had a roof over our heads and a vague promise of tickets for the following day's match. Nell McCafferty and myself were unlikely candidates for this World Cup assignment. Admittedly, Nell knew a little about Derry City FC, whereas I only had a passing knowledge of any of the Irish soccer players. But in a way, that was the genius of sending us to cover the World Cup. We were like the majority of people in Ireland that summer, when the country got swept along on a tsunami of excitement and optimism in support of Jack Charlton and his boys in green. Monday, the 25th of June 1990, was a swelteringly hot day. Nell and I had breakfast and sipped strong espressos on a shady terrace overlooking the small fishing harbour of Camogli and considered our travel options. While trains, buses and taxi services were readily available, I felt our approach should be more in keeping with Genoa's maritime history. After all, it was the birthplace of Christopher Columbus. So, following an hour of my limited and very broken Italian, lots of hand-waving and gesticulations, as well as some serious haggling, I found a speedboat owner who was prepared to ferry us up the coast, about the same distance as Greystones to O'Connell Bridge. For more than an hour, we bounced over the azure-blue waves of the Mediterranean, cooled by a sea breeze and salt spray. Our water taxi delivered us into a luxury yacht marina, which was jam-packed with squillion-dollar pleasure boats, the likes of which you'd only ever see in James Bond movies. With our feet firmly back on dry land, we regained our equilibrium and discovered that it was just a short walk to the Stadio Luigi Ferraris, Genoa's equivalent of Croke Park. The concourse around the stadium was already heaving with thousands of Irish soccer fans. Jack Charlton's travelling army had won the hearts of the Italian people for their bonhomie, irrepressible singing and insanely optimistic ambitions for the tournament. Here, Nell's status as a national icon came into its own. As she mingled among the waiting fans, she was instantly recognised and very warmly greeted. Incredible stories of how some fans had abandoned jobs at home and raised credit union loans were shared with her as if she were a long-lost but much-loved family relative. There was the intrepid granny from Talla, who had joined her son and his mates as they drove a camper van from Dublin to Cagliari in Sardinia and then onwards to Palermo in Sicily before finally ending up in the stadium car park in Genoa. No, she wasn't interested in attending the match itself, she told us. She had washed the lads' clothes and hung them on a makeshift washing line because there was great drying out that day. The match itself is imprinted on our collective unconscious. Nil all after extra time, it went to a penalty shootout, which Ireland won 5-4 after a stunning arms outstretched save by Paddy Bonner and an ice-cool tap from David O'Leary into the back of the Romanian net. The stadium went Vesuvius, as did everyone back home. 90 minutes later, Nell and myself had inveigled ourselves onto the media bus, which was travelling in convoy to the Irish team's hotel. We walked nonchalantly, eyes always forward, into the dining room to join the team and their families for the post-match celebration. We bagged a couple of seats at one table, but our lack of football knowledge quickly became apparent, as it took me until dessert before I realised that we were deep in conversation with none other than Ronnie Whelan and his family. I wrote his name on the back of a napkin, which I slipped over to Nell. After dinner, we crowded around Big Jack and had photos taken with them. In those happy snaps, Jack Charlton bears his magnificent trademark smile. Much later, Nell and myself headed back into the centre of Genoa to commune with the hordes of delirious Irish supporters, many of whom were still cooling their jets in the medieval fountain of the Piazza di Ferrari long after midnight. Already, these fans' thoughts had turned to the Stadio Olimpico in Rome, where Ireland was due to face the host nation Italy 5 days later for a place in the World Cup semi-finals. At 4 a.m., I escorted Nell back to our hotel in Camogli, and I had her up again early and sitting in a radio studio talking to Pat Kenny about our journey to Genoa. What listeners heard from Nell was a fantastical tale, recounted in an almost Joycean stream of consciousness, a retelling of our matchday wanderings. She ended that broadcast with a plea for RTE bosses to send out more money and fresh knickers. And so we made our way on to Rome, where we managed to attend one of the team's training sessions. Chatting to Paddy Bonner, I was astonished to see just how lean and athletic he was, rippling with the energy of a racehorse. We also joined the team for a special audience with Pope John Paul II, after which I lost Nell for about an hour. She'd gone walkabout in some out-of-bounds part of the Vatican and was eventually escorted back out onto St. Peter's Square by the Swiss Guard. Our Italia 90 odyssey lasted more than a week, meeting Irish fans everywhere, hearing about their joyous adventures, and then sharing their tales with Pat Kenny and an entranced nation of radio listeners. And every evening, we would find an affordable trattoria and sink into our seats to take stock of our stories, and before ever looking at a menu, Nell would order a carafe of Vino Rosso Pronto, per favore.
There's this family at the table, a mother and father and two sons, and I started telling them about the match, you see, because I was well excited. And John wrote me a wee note across the table and said, "You're talking to Ronnie Whelan." And I just froze.
You were telling Ronnie Whelan
about
the match.
And then I froze. And over his shoulder, I could see Jack Charlton. I thought, if Jack Charlton knows I'm interfering with Ronnie Whelan, he's going to do a name and dump on it. I just said, if I say nothing, if I eat nothing, if I drink nothing, nobody will even notice I'm here. I was in heaven, Pat. But I wasn't able to talk. I ruined, the Whelans are very nice. I ruined their party because they didn't know. I mean, there's this wee person sitting dead quiet opposite them. I was like a rabbit caught in headlights. I was in heaven, Pat.
And what?
I ate with the gods last night.
And did they behave like gods? I mean, were they delighted with themselves, or was it muted, or were they going every so often?
Well, you see, I mean, the blood was pounding in my ears, you know. It was like watching a silent movie. I think they were a wee bit quiet. I mean, I saw Ronnie Whelan kiss his wife. I suppose if Jack Charlton hears I saw that, I'll get killed. They were like wee boys, you know. They're going to Italy last night. I mean, they're going to sight the Italians, and they just cannot wait. They can't get over themselves. Yeah. I mean, we're in the big time now.
what you might call a late bloomer. But a turning point for me was when I came across a book called Animal Cities, Beastly Urban Histories by Peter Atkins. I was instantly hooked. I wanted to find out everything I could about Dublin's animal past. That led ultimately to a PhD thesis I'm now completing in geography. And as I dig deep into the archives, read widely and conduct interviews for that research, the world of Dublin's urban animals has come alive for me. I quickly discovered that even in my lifetime, Dublin was a city teeming with animals, especially on a Thursday, when thousands of cattle, sheep and pigs converged on the Dublin Cattle Market between Prussia Street and the North Circular Road. In the late 1950s, this was the largest cattle market in Europe. Until the market closed in 1973, it was unremarkable to see thousands of animals streaming through the north inner city on their way to Dublin Port. Understandably, this presented dangers to all concerned, animals and people alike. The route wasn't even closed to traffic. Stories of marauding cattle bursting into shops or crashing into cars and pedestrians were regularly reported in the press. At least one poor cow even ended up in the Liffey. Pictures of the time show animals surrounded by cars and buses all vying for space on the road. And the market wasn't even early in the morning. The cattle were often driven through the streets around midday, coinciding with lunchtime for the local schools when hundreds of children poured onto the streets. People I interviewed recalled how it was mayhem, but it was also the highlight of the week for many of these inner city kids who would try to help the drovers hunting the cattle, as they called it. In one interview, I was told how some younger tenement children would put on their cowboy hats to watch the spectacle. Meanwhile, before midday and in anticipation of the animal drive, mothers would take in the babies from their prams, which were routinely tied to the railings outside. But older children were left to their own devices and often enjoyed playing in and around the cattle pens, where many inadvertently picked up ringworm. These cattle were just visitors to the city, but thousands more animals actually lived there. If you spent time in Dublin in the 70s and 80s, and even later, you'll have seen plenty of urban workhorses, especially around the Liberties and the streets between Moore Street and the markets. Even today, horses in the city are a common sight, especially the jarvies on Stephen's Green taking tourists for jaunts. Living as I do beside the Phoenix Park, I love seeing the magnificent army and police horses out exercising, and the polo ponies on sunny summer evenings. I don't even mind when the teens and their trotting ponies hold up the traffic. Whatever about horses, few would consider the pig as an ideal urban animal, and yet pigs have been present in higher numbers over the city's lifetime for longer than any other animal in Dublin. I recently came across an interview in the RTE archives with pig keeper Brendan Dukes from Dolphin's Barn. It was March 1959 and Dukes was celebrating the lifting of a 2.5-year ban on pig keeping because of the outbreak of swine fever, which had begun with a pig keeper feeding his herd uncooked imported pork. At this time, Dukes had the capacity to raise 150 or so pigs. He was one of 800 pig keepers operating in the environs of the city. Some piggeries housed up to 400 pigs each. You might think that piggeries would have been isolated to the poorer areas of Dublin, but that's not the case. I was fortunate to talk to two brothers who grew up in the 1950s and 60s in Rathmines with a piggery in their yard and a slaughterhouse down the lane, around the corner from some of Dublin's wealthiest residents. Indeed, one of the last piggeries to close was in 1990 in Donnybrook in Dublin 4, another expensive address. Even though piggeries degraded the local environment with their smell, the cries for reform, even from the most powerful in society, went unheeded for decades. Today, in our highly regulated society, it's hard to imagine a livestock market in the midst of our capital city. And yet that's where ours was for generations up until a mere 50 years ago. For centuries, and still in living memory, people in Dublin depended on and lived intimately alongside animals in ways we can hardly imagine. But their stories are out there and can enrich our understanding of our city and ourselves.
I am just a cowboy, lonesome on the trail. A starry night, a campfire light. The coyote call.
When we drive through the rusty gates of the Villa di Corigliano in the early Tuscan afternoon, it's almost 40 degrees, and the sun is beating down on the scorched lawns and a couple of withering brown-leaved palm trees. We haul our luggage up the monumental steps at the front of the building and ring the bell to find there is not a soul around to welcome us into the cool halls of this palace that has belonged to the Giordano da Seta family since the 16th century. The painted decorations on the outside walls are faded and chipped, but still intriguing. Somehow the hot air is simmering with anticipation. Eventually, a lady in a white apron arrives to open up and tells us to put our luggage down in the overwhelming entrance hall, which is entirely decorated with lush frescoes depicting bacchanalian scenes from Ovid's Metamorphoses. She directs us to one of the crumbling outhouses where food is being served. "You wait there for your room and eat," she tells us. We obey meekly. The food does look appetizing. A deafening orchestra of chirping crickets accompanies our meal. The beauty of the park and the building is slowly growing on us. We realize we don't know anything about this place that has already taken hold of us. It feels as if we have been placed abruptly in a different era. When we finally get to our large but quite spartan room, we find an ancient bed and a framed note on the wall telling us that this had been the main guest room in the villa and the favourite room of Joséphine de Beauharnais, wife of Napoleon Bonaparte. She used to visit Pisa and the Villa di Corigliano monthly to be treated by a famous local doctor and perhaps have long chats with the other visitors, which included the poet Percival Shelley, as the note calls him, and his wife, Mary Shelley. If we happen to look out of the window, it says, we will spot the small, elegant building built by the family as one of the first literary cafes in Italy. There, the Shelleys, Lord Byron, Joséphine Bonaparte, and the other literary-inclined guests would sip coffee or chocolate and chat or read. We, two middle-aged poets, rush to the window, vying to be the first to see this Fata Morgana come to life, and with it the right to be the first to write about it. I win, and there it is. The small building with only three adjoining rooms to contain some of the greatest poets in history and some of the most coffee-fueled lines of magnificent poetry. The outside walls of this small coffee house are decorated with what must have been blood-red frescoes, images of lions and dragons struggling to survive in the burning glare of the 21st century's unnatural sunlight. While I mumble one of my favourite lines by Shelley, music when soft voices die, vibrates in the memory. I venture down the cellars of the palazzo in search of more mysteries. While my travelling companions gorge on gin and tonics at a table in the shade of a giant sycamore, I, who am prohibited from the joys of alcohol, gorge on curiosity about the ever darker frescoes on the walls along the steps to the cellars. In these cellars, there used to be rooms equipped for medical experiments. A famous local doctor called Francesco La Pietra used to carry out experiments there on galvanism and muscle contractions in these cellars. And sometimes Mary Shelley would pay the doctor a visit in between her writing hours. She was, of course, working on her later world-famous novel, Frankenstein, at the time. Did she draw inspiration for her book from what she observed in those cellars? It seems quite obvious. The name Francesco La Pietra translates into English as Francis Stone, or in German, Frankenstein. Later, we wander up to the now roofless literary café, a metaphor perhaps for the declining interest in poetry. We tread carefully on the grass, as if we are locked in a different time, and any abrupt movement or sound would disturb our illusion, until we reach the cracked gaps through which we can spy on poetic history. What do we hear in the hot echo of those ruined spaces, except for the rustling of snakes? Do their dreams still match ours? Not if it means acquiring a yacht like Shelley did, or Byron's endless hunting after lust objects. I could maybe share in a conversation about their love of words and of the sea, of swimming far out, or their passionate political involvements. All this accompanied by the same drone of the omnipresent crickets, and Mary Shelley, who was to become a timeless superstar author, could have sat there quietly building on the image of her Dr. Frankenstein and his monster, maybe not even listening to all these great poets' pontifications. Rumours still exist that this famous doctor and possible model for Frankenstein, who treated Josephine Bonaparte monthly for gynecological ailments, was not called Francesco, but rather Francesca, and was in fact a woman. Why did Mary Shelley not acknowledge this majorly important fact? Should I go back and ask her?
Voglio una casa, la voglio bella, piena di luce come una stella, piena di sole e di fortuna, e sopra il tetto spunti la luna, piena di riso, piena di pianto.
One August in the 1970s, when the leaving results were due to come out, the country was holding its breath. And I, a guidance counsellor in Donegal, was very worried, for I'd 3 6-year pupils who hadn't given a hoot throughout the year, although they'd streeled in from the bus day after day, their faces whipped red by the winds off Errigal. Teresa, Mary Rose and Bernadette. I remember them clearly, their high spirits and shining eyes, their skinny figures swathed in herringbone tweed. All year they'd come into the school together, giggling and teasing, loud in their shouts of "In under God," as they told the crack of the previous night when they were pulling pints in the Come On In. These lassies were clever indeed, but unruly, knew they could throw school to the wind any day they liked and come back the next, their copybooks tacky with jam, but homework done. And how I worried they'd fail their leaving, for how could they other than fail? Indeed, I suspected they even wanted to fail, but it was hard to tell, for they feared nothing more than to be sent away, maybe as far as the uni in distant Galway. When the results arrived in the school, I scanned them quickly, skipped over the rows of A's and B's of committed scholars to reach the names of the wayward. And my eyes grew wide, for incredibly, those harebrained idle lassies, those wild and windswept children, had passed the exam, had even excelled. As I laid aside the sheaf of results and had fallen to thinking about God's wonderful ways, the phone on my desk rang. "How are you doing, miss?" It was Teresa. Along with her voice, I could hear other muffled sounds like breathing and sniffling and choking, which caused me to ask where exactly she was. "I'm here, miss," she elucidated. "Here in the phone box on Mina Roy. Me and Mary Rose and Bernadette." "The three of you all together?" Ah, now I could understand the stifled giggles and the vague mumbling sounds, and I had to chuckle. For that phone box on the side of Mina Roy was one bleak and lonesome P&T box set in the heather. A remote and desolate box, beacon to many a traveller broken down on those ribbony roads at night. And now the three of them were squashed in there together, the door held tight but ajar, just enough to let the air in and keep the rain out. And I smiled, for it was obvious why they were phoning. They'd left off their work in the come on in to get their leaving results. Casually, of course, but there'd be courage in numbers. "Well, Teresa, there's good news for you." And I paused to register her delight. "You passed, and so did Mary Rose, and so did Bernadette." Then, instead of a cheer, there followed an almost total silence. Only the muffled, shuffling sounds went on, the creaking of a door and the moaning of wind. "Teresa," I called again. "Teresa!" There was no reply, so I shouted, "Can you hear me? Mary Rose? Bernadette?" In the ensuing half-silence, I could see the phone box with its tight-fitting cargo swaying in the gale, and I began to panic. Then came Mary Rose's voice. "Please, miss, it's all right. It's only that Teresa fainted." After that, just some more huffing sounds and the clank of the phone going dead. Now, I was never to find out whether it was excitement or lack of oxygen that caused Teresa to faint that day, or whether in that sweaty phone box she could see uni looming too near. Whatever the reason, I knew her pals would gather her up, and with the leaving certificates safe in their pockets, they'd head for the hills, the pulling of pints, and the dancing. 50 years on, it's a much different leaving cert world, but I can't help wondering if those lassies still laugh as they tell anxious grandchildren of how they once got their leaving results in a phone box on the side of Mina Roy.
A Victorian triangular pediment sits above a black wooden door in a red brick facade on Wicklow Street, a few doors up from Brent Thomas. I enter and climb the weary wooden stairs to a small dark room dotted with mismatched stools and tables. A galaxy of dust motes drift on the shafts of sunlight breaking in through the edges of three large black window blinds. The wall is lined with black and white photos of comedy heroes and has-beens. This ramshackle room above the International Bar is the so-called birthplace of Irish comedy. Mentioned as Ruggie O'Donoghue's in Joyce's Ulysses, the International Bar has long been associated with the literary, musical and theatrical life of the city. Every Sunday evening at 8 p.m, the Dublin Comedy Improv take to the stage to perform an unrehearsed, unwritten, improvised comedy show based on the shouted suggestions of audience members. There are 8 members in the group and 4 of us perform in any given show, so in general, I am here 2 Sundays a month making things up. Hopefully funny things, but that's not guaranteed, and that's what makes improvisation so magical. Whatever happens is never going to happen again. It's not preserved on video, written down, or recorded hourly. Probably for the better, as what's funny in the moment with an audience that have become one cliquey group for just that one night may not stand up to examination in the cold light of day. Daylight, the enemy of show business. This room has history as being where some of Ireland's most renowned comedians and singer-songwriters developed their skills. What is it about this room that made it a kind of womb where so many comedians and singer-songwriters could develop? Is it its layout? The lack of expectation? The rundown nature of the building and the stubborn nature of the owners who refused to sell out in the boom times and resolved to struggle through the recessions? Every city needs these rooms where outsider youths can congregate and do their weird, unformulated attempts at expression. A place where the complex ideas they reach for, assemble and rehearse in dusty bedsits and basements can be unleashed before an audience of 50 or so like-minded folks. This is the room where comedians and songwriters such as Ardla Hanlon, Dylan Moran, Glenn Hansard and Mundy made their first tentative steps into the world of performance. The struggle of creation can be romanticised by tour guides and historians long after everyone's dead, but there's nothing romantic about those early, wide-eyed, hungry days. The walls and floorboards of the International Bar must have cringed 1,000 times at the unhoned efforts it witnessed. Thank God the walls can't speak. I can't say I expected to be climbing these stairs as I approached my 60th birthday. I may have expected a sold-out run in Vicar Street or a sketch show on Channel 4. Maybe it's all for the better. I had other things to attend to, personal matters. Maybe there was a little voice in my head that told me fame and fortune were not things I needed, and me with a delicate hold on my ego and a deep fear of being just me. Or maybe I blew it or just wasn't good enough. It seems like not so long ago we were wide-eyed wannabes, and now somehow we have become something that could be called an institution. 3 decades on, this improv show has survived. Through marriages, divorces and babies. Through babies becoming adults and their parents resuming a social life. I sit around the table set aside for the performers and we engage in the usual banter as we wait for Ian to introduce the show. Ian Coppinger, along with Michelle Reid, are the only 2 original members of the Comedy Improv, having stuck it out through thick and thin for 30 years. And there was plenty of thin. It wasn't always a full house. Indeed, for much of the later 2000s, we played a Monday night show to 10 or 20 or 30 people. On one night, one of those 30 was Chris Martin, the singer of Coldplay. Afterwards, we'd divvy up the money, which would barely cover petrol. Back then, we needed to explain what improv was to skeptics who clearly in the back of their mind were thinking, it's not real comedy, though. Personally, I stuck with it because I just loved performing the show. I loved making stuff up on the spot. The stream of consciousness blather was energising and probably therapeutic. There were the times when we got an irrepressible fit of the giggles that was joyously childish. The times we became a bunch of potty-mouthed teenagers, 40 and 50-somethings laughing because we said rude words. There were times when the audience just weren't on board and we had to plough through the silence in the belief that we'd look back and say, it was character building. These days we play to sold out audiences of every nation under the sun, and the fact we actually get fairly well paid makes it a little better. Come 8 o'clock, Ian takes to the stage and announces, welcome to the Dublin Comedy Improv. The crowd cheer, and I wouldn't want to be anywhere else.
Star, star, teach me how to shine, shine. Teach me so I know what's going on in your mind. 'Cause I don't understand these people saying the hill's too steep. Well, they talk and talk forever, but they just never
climb. Platform 1 East. Before the sweat and bustle, the long stretch of platforms, us dragging our life on wheels to a small train heading inland, let us whoosh upwards in a lift to the top of this old building, stand amongst the roof terraces, terracotta pots, and gaze over at the ribbed slates and domes. Let's look down to what was our night together last night, the underground restaurant, tomato sauce staining my cloth, the twirl of spaghetti knots, and after, the scarred men in a circle of drugs whistling at you, our oblivious daughter. A single leaping rat guided us through shadowy laneways to our airless shuttered room. One last look. Platform 1 East waiting, the engine raring to go to bring us north of Rome, away from all this noise and grime, from all of this relentless beauty.
On this morning's programme, we heard from the recent archive in tribute to the late Noel McCafferty, Vino Rosso Pronto Per Favore by John Egan. Hunt in the Castle was by Anne-Marie Durkin. Frankenstein in Tuscany by Judith Mock. Also from the recent archive, The Leaving Results by Norma McMaster. The International Bar was by Joe Rooney. And Platform 1 East, a poem by Enda Wiley. The music this morning was Puccini's Nessun Dorma. That was sung by Pavarotti. And before that, an excerpt of Nell McCafferty's reporting on Italian 90 on the Pat Kenny Show on RTE Radio 1. Cowboy Song by Thin Lizzy, Voglio una casa by L'Arpeggiata, The Glory Reel by Alton, and Star Star by The Frames. And if you're interested in studying geography at third level, as mentioned in Anne-Marie Durkin's piece, it's offered in many Irish universities, including DCU, which is currently hosting thousands of delegates at the 35th International Geographical Congress. See geographicalsocietyireland.ie for more details. Sunday Miscellany's broadcast coordinator is Elaine Conlon. The producer is Sarah Binchy. You can listen back on the programme website, rte.ie/radio/radio1/Sunday Miscellany, and on the RTE Radio app.
You've been listening to the Sunday Miscellany podcast. For more from us, you can follow the programme on Facebook, Twitter, Spotify, or Apple Podcasts. Just search for RTE Sunday Miscellany.